The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here to fill us in on some recent stories on our daily news site. So first, David, a robotic look at the evolution of bird flight.
Right, Stuart. This story is all about how a tiny robot could solve a very big biological mystery. And that mystery is, what good would a primitive wing have done? I mean, obviously, full-fledged wings are very useful. They allowed birds and other creatures to fly around in the sky. But wings just didn't appear out of nowhere. There must have been some sort of proto-wing. And the question is, what use would that have served?
So where do the robots come in solving that problem?
Well, the robots come in trying to help researchers decide which of two hypotheses make the most sense. One hypothesis basically says that flying evolved from gliding, that animals were sort of gliding down from the trees. They would need some sort of wing-like structure to do that, not necessarily a structure that would let them flap around and fly, but would help them glide better. This is called the trees down idea. The other one is called the run flap idea. And the idea with this is sort of more of a ground up situation where animals would be flapping a wing-like structure while they ran across the ground. And this might help them get over obstacles better or steep inclines. The funny thing is that the engineers that created this robot had no interest in this biological question. They want to create a cool robot for the U.S. military to help it sort of spy and do all the things that the U.S. military does. And basically, they created this tiny little 25-gram robot that has a pair of wings that can flap around. The robot doesn't fly, but the wings do sort of all the other things that normal wings do. And when they heard about this biological debate, they said, I wonder if our little robot could help solve this problem. And so what they did was they ran the robot through basically a mini Olympics obstacle course. And they had the robot do things like, you know, gliding from one object to another, but also running very quickly across the ground and trying to see if these wing structures help the robot get over certain obstacles like some scientists had posited might have happened with early winged animals. And you can actually see a video of this happening on the site. It's actually kind of fun.
So what do these videos show?
Well, the video basically shows that flapping wings seem to help a lot with all of these tasks, with the gliding and with getting up steep inclines and actually getting over obstacles as well. But they helped with gliding most of all. So in terms of, you know, the flapping while these robots were running on the ground, they were able to increase their speed by about 90%, but they would need to increase their speed by 400% to actually fly, which indicates that...
To get off the ground.
Get off the ground, exactly. So it indicates that maybe these wings weren't so useful for early flight or the development of flight, but when it came to gliding, it turns out these robots were able to sail much farther from one object to the next when they were flapping these wing-like structures and then when they weren't. So at least according to the work done with this robot, the researchers are saying, you know, we really think that it's these wings that were important for gliding. And
trees down rather than ground up.
Exactly.
And next, a certain amount of plasticity in teenage IQs.
Right. Well, this study, Stuart, is about IQ, which is kind of a controversial concept. A lot of scientists dismiss the idea that IQ actually really means anything about our innate intelligence. But what a lot of researchers do agree on is that IQ does seem to be predictive for our ability to learn, to perform certain tasks, and it even may be somewhat predictive of our later academic achievement and job performance. So there's some importance to IQ. Nobody's really sure what it is. But this is really not about what does IQ mean. It's does IQ change? There's been a debate in the scientific community about whether IQ changes over time or whether you basically, once your IQ score is set, that's basically your IQ for your life, no matter sort of what you do.
And so someone set up a way to test that?
Exactly. And they tested it on teenagers. They looked at 19 boys and 14 girls, and they tested these kids in both 2004 and 2008. And what they did was they gave them some tests that would test IQ. And at the same time, they had them sit in these MRI machines, which measure
magnetic resonance imaging.
Exactly. And this measures brain activity. And while the teenagers were in there, they were performing verbal tasks like reading or naming objects. They were also doing nonverbal tasks like solving puzzles with their hands. And the idea was to see if there was a correlation between IQ and how they were doing on these activities and any sort of differences in brain activity or brain structure. And actually what the researchers found, which was really surprising, is that the IQ varied by as much as 20 points between the two times that these kids were tested between 2004 and 2008. Whereas before people were saying, you know, IQ is probably just set, this team was showing that it wasn't set, that it was kind of flexible. Not only that, but there was also differences in the gray matter of these kids, and that seemed to correlate with higher IQ scores. The bigger the IQ score, the more the kid seemed to have an increase in gray matter density, and this gray matter correlated to particular parts of the brain that were involved in the tasks they were doing, so that if a kid was doing better on speech or had a better IQ speech score, the gray matter in this region would be higher.
Well, that 20 points is pretty significant. I mean, the average IQ is 100 points, right?
Exactly, exactly. So these are really big differences, and the researchers say why this is important is because if IQ is not fixed, it could mean that there are ways to intervene. So if IQ is really tied to things like future success in your job or academics, you're not necessarily stuck with the IQ that you have. If you have a lower IQ, perhaps you could do something to improve it.
So this means that adolescents at least can potentially boost their intelligence, or at least whatever it is that IQ measures as intelligence. What about the rest of us?
And that's a great question, Stuart. And that's something that researchers are looking at now, whether it's not just the adolescent brain, but the brains of the rest of us, you know, can be malleable as well.
And finally, obesity may depend on the neighborhood you live in, it appears.
Right. Well, this next story is kind of controversial. It suggests that just the neighborhood you live in can determine things like obesity and diabetes. And this has been an idea that's been around actually since the 1920s, the idea that if you maybe live in a poor neighborhood, you're more prone to obesity and diabetes and other problems than if you live in a middle-class neighborhood. Now, it kind of makes sense, but with issues like this, it's always a question of correlation versus causation. You know, are people that live in bad neighborhoods, are they in these neighborhoods because they're already predisposed to these conditions and the neighborhood doesn't really make much of a difference? Or is the neighborhood itself actually playing an active role, as much as a neighborhood can play an active role, in these problems?
So how would you sort such a thing out?
Well, it turns out that actually the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is responsible for housing issues for the U.S. government, actually carried out an experiment in the 1990s where they took people that were from poor neighborhoods and they gave some of them rent vouchers, which allowed them, if they wanted to move out of that neighborhood, move into a middle-class neighborhood and not have to pay any extra money. Some of them took the rent vouchers and did that. Some of them kept the money and they just stayed in the lower-class neighborhood, and some of them didn't get any rent vouchers at all. And during this whole period, this was about a 4 or 5 year study, another group of researchers also stepped in and measured the health of these people. They took their height, their weight, and they actually even looked at their blood. They looked at the amount of hemoglobin in the blood that was bonded to sugar molecules, and this is an indicator for diabetes.
And so what did they find from looking at all of this?
Well, they found that indeed neighborhoods matter, that people that moved into middle-class neighborhoods from the lower-class neighborhoods were about 5% less likely to become obese and show signs of diabetes. Now, 5% may not sound like a lot, but a lot of the drugs that are out there that target weight and diabetes don't actually do much better than that, which is really interesting because it means that simply moving to a different neighborhood can be as effective as taking some weight loss and diabetes drugs.
Well, I suppose moving to a different neighborhood might be a little harder than,
exactly.
than taking a drug.
That is very true, and a lot more expensive potentially.
What's behind these effects?
Well, that's the next question. So now researchers feel that they've actually shown that there is an effect of neighborhoods, and this is an active effect. This is causation, not just a correlation. But there's still a big question about why this would be the case. Is it the case that, you know, people in middle-class neighborhoods, maybe there's more open space, there's less crime, and so you're more likely to be walking around outside and you're going to lose weight and that's going to be healthier for you? Or maybe there's just healthier people around you. Hmm. There's thinner people, there's people that are in better shape, and maybe that rubs off on you. There's some sort of, you know, health peer pressure going on and people are more likely to live a healthy lifestyle that live in those neighborhoods. So that's the next step to figure out exactly what's going on. But for right now, they've got this really interesting finding that they can build on.
Okay, Dave, so what else are you looking at for the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story about poisonous seaweed. Also, we'll be announcing the winner of our 2011 Dance Your PhD contest. Mm. This is a yearly contest we run, which invites grad students and scientists and postdocs, anybody who's got a PhD to dance.
And a bottle of whiskey.
Exactly, exactly. And who's not too self-conscious to actually get in front of a camera and interpret their PhD in dance form. We've been doing this for a few years. It's a lot of fun. You can go on the site and you can see all of the videos from the entrance. You can see our finalists. And today you can actually go on the site and figure out who won the contest from over the 50 entries that we had. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about what's going on with stem cells in Europe, also about desperate times at the National Institute of Health and how the Institute is reaching out to scientists to figure out ways to best deal with the budget crunch that it's facing. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat is about the science of cloaking. So tune in to ask experts questions about how to make things disappear.
That's right. I hope you have some Romulans.
Right. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.